Chapter 12 The Tri-Wizard Tournament. Through the gates, flanked with statues of winged boars, and up the sweeping drive the carriages trundled, swaying dangerously in what was fast becoming a gale. Leaning against the window, Harry could see Hogwarts coming nearer, its many lighted windows blurred and shimmering behind the thick curtain of rain. Lightning flashed across the sky as their carriage came to a halt before the great oak front doors, which stood at the top of a flight of stone steps. People who had occupied the carriages in front were already hurrying up the stone steps into the castle. Harry, Ron, Hermione and Neville jumped down from their carriage and dashed up the steps too, looking up only when they were safely inside the cavernous, torch-lit entrance hall with its magnificent marble staircase. "Blimey!" said Ron, shaking his head and sending water everywhere. "If that keeps up, the lake's going to overflow. I'm soaked. Ah!" A large, red, water-filled balloon had dropped from out of the ceiling onto Ron's head and exploded. Drenched and spluttering, Ron staggered sideways into Harry, just as a second water bomb dropped. Narrowly missing Hermione, it burst at Harry's feet, sending a wave of cold water over his trainers into his socks. People all around them shrieked and started pushing each other in their efforts to get out of the line of fire. Harry looked up and saw, floating 20 feet above them, Peeves the Poltergeist, a little man in a bell-covered hat and orange bow tie, his wide, malicious face contorted with concentration as he took aim again. "Peeves!" yelled an angry voice. "Peeves, come down here at once!" Professor McGonagall, deputy headmistress and head of Gryffindor House, had come dashing out of the great hall. She skidded on the wet floor and grabbed Hermione around the neck to stop herself falling. "Ouch! Sorry, Miss Granger." "That's all right, Professor," Hermione gasped, massaging her throat. "Peeves, get down here now," barked Professor McGonagall, straightening her pointed hat and glaring upwards through her square-rimmed spectacles. "Not doing nothing," cackled Peeves, lobbing a water bomb at several fifth-year girls who screamed and dived into the great hall. "Already wet, aren't they, little squirts? Whee!" And he aimed another bomb at a group of second years who had just arrived. "I shall call the headmaster," shouted Professor McGonagall. "I'm warning you, Peeves." Peeves stuck out his tongue, threw the last of his water bombs into the air, and zoomed off up the marble staircase, cackling insanely. "Well, move along then," said Professor McGonagall sharply to the bedraggled crowd. "Into the great hall. Come on." Harry, Ron, and Hermione slipped and slid across the entrance hall and through the double doors on the right, Ron muttering furiously under his breath as he pushed his sopping hair off his face. The great hall looked its usual splendid self, decorated for the start-of-term feast. Golden plates and goblets gleamed by the light of hundreds and hundreds of candles floating over the tables in mid-air. The four long house tables were packed with chattering students. At the top of the hall, the staff sat along one side of a fifth table, facing their pupils. It was much warmer in here. Harry, Ron, and Hermione walked past the Slytherins, the Ravenclaws, and the Hufflepuffs, and sat down with the rest of the Gryffindors at the far side of the hall, next to nearly headless Nick, the Gryffindor ghost. Pearly white and semi-transparent, Nick was dressed tonight in his usual doublet, with a particularly large ruff, which served the dual purpose of looking extra festive and ensuring that his head didn't wobble too much on his partially severed neck. "Good evening," he said, beaming at them. "Says who?" said Harry, taking off his trainers and emptying them of water. "Hope they hurry up with the sorting. I'm starving." The sorting of the new students into houses took place at the start of every school year, but by an unlucky combination of circumstances, Harry hadn't been present at one since his own. He was quite looking forward to it. Just then, a highly excited, breathless voice called down the table. "Hiya, Harry!" It was Colin Creevy, a third year to whom Harry was something of a hero. "Hi, Colin," said Harry, warily.
"Harry, guess what? Guess what, Harry? My brother's starting. My brother Dennis."
"Good," said Harry.
"He's really excited," said Colin, practically bouncing up and down in his seat. "I just hope he's in Gryffindor. Keep your fingers crossed, eh, Harry?"
"Yeah, all right," said Harry. He turned back to Hermione, Ron, and nearly headless Nick. "Brothers and sisters usually go in the same houses, don't they?" he said. He was judging by the Weasleys, all seven of whom had been put into Gryffindor.
"Oh, no, not necessarily," said Hermione. "Parvati Patil's twins in Ravenclaw, and they're identical. You'd think they'd be together, wouldn't you?"
Harry looked up at the staff table. There seemed to be rather more empty seats there than usual. Hagrid, of course, was still fighting his way across the lake with the first years. Professor McGonagall was presumably supervising the drying of the entrance hall floor, but there was another empty chair too, and he couldn't think who else was missing.
"Where's the new Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher?" said Hermione, who was also looking up at the teachers.
They had never yet had a Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher who had lasted more than 3 terms. Harry's favourite by far had been Professor Lupin, who had resigned last year. He looked up and down the staff table. There was definitely no new face there.
"Maybe they couldn't get anyone," said Hermione, looking anxious.
Harry scanned the table more carefully. Tiny little Professor Flitwick, the charms teacher, was sitting on a large pile of cushions beside Professor Sprout, the herbology teacher, whose hat was askew over her flyaway grey hair. She was talking to Professor Sinistra of the astronomy department. On Professor Sinistra's other side was the sallow-faced, hook-nosed, greasy-haired potions master, Snape, Harry's least favourite person at Hogwarts. Harry's loathing of Snape was matched only by Snape's hatred of him, a hatred which had, if possible, intensified last year when Harry had helped Sirius escape right under Snape's over-large nose. Snape and Sirius had been enemies since their own school days. On Snape's other side was an empty seat, which Harry guessed was Professor McGonagall's. Next to it, and in the very centre of the table, sat Professor Dumbledore, the headmaster, his sweeping silver hair and beard shining in the candlelight, his magnificent deep green robes embroidered with many stars and moons. The tips of Dumbledore's long, thin fingers were together, and he was resting his chin upon them, staring up at the ceiling through his half-moon spectacles, as though lost in thought. Harry glanced up at the ceiling too. It was enchanted to look like the sky outside, and he had never seen it look this stormy. Black and purple clouds were swirling across it, and as another thunderclap sounded outside, a fork of lightning flashed across it.
"Oh, hurry up," Ron moaned beside Harry. "I could eat a hippogriff."
The words were no sooner out of his mouth than the doors of the great hall opened and silence fell. Professor McGonagall was leading a long line of first years up to the top of the hall. If Harry, Ron, and Hermione were wet, it was nothing to how these first years looked. They appeared to have swum across the lake rather than sailing. All of them were shivering with a combination of cold and nerves as they filed along the staff table and came to a halt in a line facing the rest of the school. All of them, except the smallest of the lot, a boy with mousy hair, who was wrapped in what Harry recognised as Hagrid's moleskin overcoat. The coat was so big for him that it looked as though he was draped in a furry black marquee. His small face protruded from over the collar, looking almost painfully excited. When he had lined up with his terrified-looking peers, he caught Colin Creevey's eye, gave a double thumbs up, and mouthed, "I fell in the lake!" He looked positively delighted about it. Professor McGonagall now placed a 3-legged stool on the ground before the first years, and, on top of it, an extremely old, dirty, patched wizard's hat. The first years stared at it. So did everyone else. For a moment there was silence. Then a tear near the brim opened wide like a mouth, and the hat broke into song. 1,000 years or more ago, when I was newly sown, There lived four wizards of renown, whose names are still well known. Bold Gryffindor from Wild Moor, fair Ravenclaw from Glen, sweet Hufflepuff from Valley Broad, shrewd Slytherin from Fen. They shared a wish, a hope, a dream, they hatched a daring plan, to educate young sorcerers. Thus Hogwarts School began. Now each of these four founders formed their own house, for each did value different virtues in the ones they had to teach. By Gryffindor the bravest were, prized far beyond the rest. For Ravenclaw the cleverest would always be the best. For Hufflepuff hard workers were, most worthy of admission. And power-hungry Slytherin loved those of great ambition. While still alive they did divide their favourites from the throng, yet how to pick the worthy ones when they were dead and gone? 'Twas Gryffindor who found the way, he whipped me off his head. The founders put some brains in me, so I could choose instead. Now slip me snug about your ears, I've never yet been wrong. I'll have a look inside your mind, and tell where you belong. The great hall rang with applause as the Sorting Hat finished.
That's not the song it sang when it sorted us, said Harry, clapping along with everyone else.
Sings a different one every year, said Ron. It's got to be a pretty boring life, hasn't it, being a hat? I suppose it spends all year making up the next one.
Professor McGonagall was now unrolling a large scroll of parchment.
"When I call out your name, you will put on the hat and sit on the stool," she told the first years. "When the hat announces your house, you will go and sit at the appropriate table. Ackerley Stewart."
A boy walked forward, visibly trembling from head to foot, picked up the Sorting Hat, put it on, and sat down on the stool.
"Ravenclaw!" shouted the hat.
Stuart Ackerley took off the hat and hurried into a seat at the Ravenclaw table, where everyone was applauding him. Harry caught a glimpse of Cho, the Ravenclaw seeker, cheering Stuart Ackerley as he sat down. For a fleeting second, Harry had a strange desire to join the Ravenclaw table too.
"Baddock, Malcolm!
Slytherin!"
The table on the other side of the hall erupted with cheers. Harry could see Malfoy clapping as Baddock joined the Slytherins. Harry wondered whether Baddock knew that Slytherin House had turned out more dark witches and wizards than any other. Fred and George hissed Malcolm Baddock as he sat down.
"Branstone, Eleanor!
Hufflepuff!
Caldwell, Owen!
Hufflepuff!
Creevy, Dennis!"
Tiny Dennis Creevy staggered forward, tripping over Hagrid's moleskin, just as Hagrid himself sidled into the hall through a door behind the teacher's table. About twice as tall as a normal man, and at least three times as broad, Hagrid, with his long, wild, tangled black hair and beard, looked slightly alarming. A misleading impression, for Harry, Ron, and Hermione knew Hagrid to possess a very kind nature. He winked at them as he sat down at the end of the staff table and watched Dennis Creevy putting on the Sorting Hat. The rip at the brim opened wide.
"Gryffindor!"
the hat shouted. Hagrid clapped along with the Gryffindors as Dennis Creevy, beaming widely, took off the hat, placed it back on the stool, and hurried over to join his brother.
"Colin, I fell in!"
he said shrilly, throwing himself into an empty seat.
"It was brilliant, and something in the water grabbed me and pushed me back in the boat!"
"Cool!" said Colin, just as excitedly. "It was probably the giant squid, Dennis!"
"Wow!"
said Dennis, as though nobody in their wildest dreams could hope for more than being thrown into a storm-tossed, fathoms-deep lake and pushed out of it again by a giant sea monster.
"Dennis, Dennis, see that boy down there, the one with the black hair and glasses? See him? Know who he is, Dennis?"
Harry looked away, staring very hard at the Sorting Hat, now sorting Emma Dobbs. The sorting continued, boys and girls with varying degrees of fright on their faces moving one by one to the three-legged stool, the line dwindling slowly as Professor McGonagall passed the L's.
"Oh, hurry up!" Ron moaned, massaging his stomach.
"Now, Ron, the sorting's much more important than food," said nearly headless Nick, as
"Madly, Laura!" became a Hufflepuff.
"Course it is if you're dead," snapped Ron. "I do hope this year's batch of Gryffindors are up to scratch," said nearly headless Nick, applauding as
"MacDonald, Natalie!"
joined the Gryffindor table. "We don't want to break our winning streak, do we?" Gryffindor had won the Inter-House Championship for the last 3 years in a row.
"Pritchard, Graham!"
"Slytherin!"
"Quirk, Orla!"
"Ravenclaw!"
And finally, with
"Whitby, Kevin!"
"Hufflepuff!"
the sorting ended. Professor McGonagall picked up the hat and the stool and carried them away.
"About time," said Ron, seizing his knife and fork and looking expectantly at his golden plate.
Professor Dumbledore had got to his feet. He was smiling around at the students, his arms opened wide in welcome.
"I have only 2 words to say to you," he told them, his deep voice echoing around the hall. "Tuck in."
"Hear, hear," said Harry and Ron loudly, as the empty dishes filled magically before their eyes. Nearly headless Nick watched mournfully as Harry, Ron, and Hermione loaded their plates.
"Ah, that's better," said Ron,
with his mouth full of mashed potato.
"You're lucky there's a feast at all tonight, you know," said nearly headless Nick. "There was trouble in the kitchens earlier."
"Why, what happened?"
said Harry, through a sizable chunk of steak.
"Peeves, of course," said nearly headless Nick, shaking his head, which wobbled dangerously.
He pulled his ruff a little higher up his neck.
"The usual argument, you know. He wanted to attend the feast. Well, it's quite out of the question, you know what he's like. Utterly uncivilized. Can't see a plate of food without throwing it. We held a ghost's council. The fat friar was all for giving him the chance, but most wisely, in my opinion, the bloody baron put his foot down."
The bloody baron was the Slytherin ghost, a gaunt and silent spectre covered in silver bloodstains. He was the only person at Hogwarts who could really control Peeves.
"Yeah, we thought Peeves seemed hacked off about something," said Ron, darkly. "So what did he do in the kitchens?"
"Oh, the usual," said nearly headless Nick, shrugging. "Wreaked havoc and mayhem, pots and pans everywhere, place swimming in soup, terrified the house elves out of their wits."
Clang!
Hermione had knocked over her golden goblet. Pumpkin juice spread steadily over the tablecloth, staining several feet of white linen orange. But Hermione paid no attention.
"There are house elves here," she said, staring, horror-struck, at nearly headless Nick. "Here, at Hogwarts!"
"Certainly," said nearly headless Nick, looking surprised at her reaction. "The largest number in any dwelling in Britain, I believe. 100.
"I've never seen one," said Hermione.
"Well, they hardly ever leave the kitchen by day, do they?" said nearly headless Nick. "They come out at night to do a bit of cleaning, see to the fires and so on. I mean, you're not supposed to see them, are you? That's the mark of a good house elf, isn't it? That you don't know it's there."
Hermione stared at him.
"But they get paid," she said. "They get holidays, don't they? And sick leave and pensions and everything."
Nearly headless Nick chortled so much that his ruff slipped and his head flopped off, dangling on the inch or so of ghostly skin and muscle that still attached it to his neck.
"Sick leave and pensions," he said, pushing his head back onto his shoulders and securing it once more with his ruff. "House elves don't want sick leave and pensions."
Hermione looked down at her hardly touched plate of food, then put her knife and fork down upon it and pushed it away from her.
"Oh, come on, Hermione,"
said Ron, accidentally spraying Harry with bits of Yorkshire pudding.
"Oops, sorry, Harry."
He swallowed.
You won't get them sick leave by starving yourself.
Slave labour, said Hermione, breathing hard through her nose. That's what made this dinner. Slave labour. And she refused to eat another bite. The rain was still drumming heavily against the high, dark windows. Another clap of thunder shook the windows, and the stormy ceiling flashed, illuminating the golden plates as the remains of the first course vanished and were replaced instantly with puddings.
"Treacle tart, Hermione," said Ron, deliberately wafting its smell towards her. "Spotted Dick, look! Chocolate gâteau!"
But Hermione gave him a look so reminiscent of Professor McGonagall that he gave up. When the puddings, too, had been demolished, and the last crumbs had faded off the plates, leaving them sparkling clean, Albus Dumbledore got to his feet again. The buzz of chatter filling the hall ceased almost at once, so that only the howling wind and pounding rain could be heard.
"So," said Dumbledore, smiling around at them all, "now that we're all fed and watered..."
"Humph," said Hermione.
"I must once more ask for your attention, while I give out a few notices. Mr. Filch, the caretaker, has asked me to tell you that the list of objects forbidden inside the castle has this year been extended to include screaming yo-yos, fanged frisbees, and ever-bashing boomerangs. The full list comprises some 437 items, I believe, and can be viewed in Mr. Filch's office, if anybody would like to check it."
The corners of Dumbledore's mouth twitched. He continued,
"As ever, I would like to remind you all that the forest in the grounds is out of bounds to students, as is the village of Hogsmeade to all below third year. It is also my painful duty to inform you that the Inter-House Quidditch Cup will not take place this year."
"What?" Harry gasped. He looked around at Fred and George, his fellow members of the Quidditch team. They were mouthing soundlessly at Dumbledore, apparently too appalled to speak. Dumbledore continued,
"This is due to an event that will be starting in October and continuing throughout the school year, taking up much of the teachers' time and energy, but I am sure you will all enjoy it immensely. I have great pleasure in announcing that this year at Hogwarts..."
But at that moment there was a deafening rumble of thunder, and the doors of the great hall banged open. A man stood in the doorway, leaning upon a long staff, shrouded in a black travelling cloak. Every head in the great hall swiveled towards the stranger, suddenly brightly illuminated by a fork of lightning that flashed across the ceiling. He lowered his hood, shook out a long mane of grizzled, dark grey hair, then began to walk up towards the teacher's table. A dull clunk echoed through the hall on his every other step. He reached the end of the top table, turned right, and limped heavily towards Dumbledore. Another flash of lightning crossed the ceiling. Hermione gasped. The lightning had thrown the man's face into sharp relief, and it was a face unlike any Harry had ever seen. It looked as though it had been carved out of weathered wood by someone who had only the vaguest idea of what human faces were supposed to look like, and was none too skilled with a chisel. Every inch of skin seemed to be scarred. The mouth looked like a diagonal gash, and a large chunk of the nose was missing. But it was the man's eyes that made him frightening. One of them was small, dark, and beady. The other was large, round as a coin, and a vivid electric blue. The blue eye was moving ceaselessly, without blinking, and was rolling up, down, and from side to side, quite independently of the normal eye. And then it rolled right over, pointing into the back of the man's head, so that all they could see was whiteness. The stranger reached Dumbledore. He stretched out a hand that was as badly scarred as his face, and Dumbledore shook it, muttering words Harry couldn't hear. He seemed to be making some inquiry of the stranger, who shook his head unsmilingly and replied in an undertone. Dumbledore nodded and gestured the man to the empty seat on his right-hand side. The stranger sat down, shook his mane of dark grey hair out of his face, pulled a plate of sausages towards him, raised it to what was left of his nose, and sniffed it. He then took a small knife out of his pocket, speared a sausage on the end of it, and began to eat. His normal eye was fixed upon the sausages, but the blue eye was still darting restlessly around in its socket, taking in the hall and the students.
"May I introduce our new Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher?" said Dumbledore brightly into the silence. "Professor Moody."
It was usual for new staff members to be greeted with applause, but none of the staff or students clapped except Dumbledore and Hagrid. Both put their hands together and applauded, but the sound echoed dismally into the silence, and they stopped fairly quickly. Everyone else seemed too transfixed by Moody's bizarre appearance to do more than stare at him.
"Moody?" Harry muttered to Ron. "Mad Eye Moody, the one your dad went to help this morning?"
"Must be," said Ron in a low, awed voice.
"What happened to him?" Hermione whispered. "What happened to his face?"
"Dunno," Ron whispered back, watching Moody with fascination. Moody seemed totally indifferent to his less than warm welcome. Ignoring the jug of pumpkin juice in front of him, he reached again into his travelling cloak, pulled out a hip flask, and took a long draught from it. As he lifted his arm to drink, his cloak was pulled a few inches from the ground, and Harry saw, below the table, several inches of carved wooden leg, ending in a clawed foot. Dumbledore cleared his throat again.
"As I was saying," he said, smiling at the sea of students before him, all of whom were still gazing transfixed at Mad-Eye Moody, "we are to have the honour of hosting a very exciting event over the coming months, an event which has not been held for over a century. It is my very great pleasure to inform you that the Tri-Wizard Tournament will be taking place at Hogwarts this year."
"You're joking," said Fred Weasley loudly.
The tension that had filled the hall ever since Moody's arrival suddenly broke. Nearly everyone laughed, and Dumbledore chuckled appreciatively.
"I am not joking, Mr. Weasley," he said. "Though, now you mention it, I did hear an excellent one over the summer about a troll, a hag, and a leprechaun who all go into a bar."
Professor McGonagall cleared her throat loudly.
Maybe this is not the time. No, said Dumbledore. Where was I? Oh, yes, the Tri-Wizard Tournament. Well, some of you will not know what this tournament involves, so I hope those who do know will forgive me for giving a short explanation and allow their attention to wander freely. The Tri-Wizard Tournament was first established some 700 years ago as a friendly competition between the three largest European schools of wizardry, Hogwarts, Beauxbatons, and Durmstrang. A champion was selected to represent each school, and the three champions competed in three magical tasks. The schools took it in turns to host the tournament once every 5 years, and it was generally agreed to be a most excellent way of establishing ties between young witches and wizards of different nationalities, until, that is, the death toll mounted so high that the tournament was discontinued.
"Death toll?" Hermione whispered, looking alarmed, but her anxiety did not seem to be shared by the majority of students in the hall. Many of them were whispering excitedly with each other, and Harry himself was far more interested in hearing more about the tournament than in worrying about deaths that had happened hundreds of years ago.
"There have been several attempts over the centuries to reinstate the tournament," Dumbledore continued, "none of which have been very successful. However, our own departments of international magical cooperation and magical games and sports have decided the time is ripe for another attempt. We have worked hard over the summer to ensure that this time no champion will find himself or herself in mortal danger. The heads of Beaubaton and Durmstrang will be arriving with their shortlisted contenders in October, and the selection of the three champions will take place at Halloween. An impartial judge will decide which students are most worthy to compete for the Triwizard Cup, the glory of their school, and 1,000 galleons' personal prize money.
"I'm going for it!" Fred Weasley hissed down the table, his face lit with enthusiasm at the prospect of such glory and riches.
He was not the only person who seemed to be visualizing themselves as Hogwarts champion. At every house table, Harry could see people either gazing raptly at Dumbledore or else whispering fervently to their neighbours. But then Dumbledore spoke again, and the hall quietened once more.
"Eager though I know all of you will be to bring the Triwizard Cup to Hogwarts," he said, "the heads of the participating schools, along with the Ministry of Magic, have agreed to impose an age restriction on contenders this year. Only students who are of age, that is to say 17 years or older, will be allowed to put forward their names for consideration. This..." Dumbledore raised his voice slightly, for several people had made noises of outrage at these words, and the Weasley twins were suddenly looking furious, "is a measure we feel is necessary, given that the tournament tasks will still be difficult and dangerous, whatever precautions we take, and it is highly unlikely that students below 6th and 7th year will be able to cope with them. I will personally be ensuring that no underage student hoodwinks our impartial judge into making them Hogwarts champion." His light blue eyes twinkled as they flickered over Fred and George's mutinous faces. "I therefore beg you not to waste your time submitting yourself if you are under 17. The delegations from Beaubaton and Durmstrang will be arriving in October, and remaining with us for the greater part of this year. I know that you will all extend every courtesy to our foreign guests while they are with us, and will give your wholehearted support to the Hogwarts champion when he or she is selected. And now it is late, and I know how important it is to you all to be alert and rested as you enter your lessons tomorrow morning. Bedtime! Chop, chop!" Dumbledore sat down again and turned to talk to Mad-Eye Moody. There was a great scraping and banging as all the students got to their feet and swarmed towards the double doors into the entrance hall.
"They can't do that!" said George Weasley, who had not joined the crowd moving towards the door, but was standing up and glaring at Dumbledore. "We're 17 in April. Why can't we have a shot?"
"They're not stopping me entering," said Fred stubbornly, also scowling at the top table. "The champions will get to do all sorts of stuff you'd never be allowed to do normally, and 1,000 galleons prize money."
"Yeah," said Ron, a faraway look on his face. "Yeah, 1,000 galleons.
"Come on," said Hermione. "We'll be the only ones left here if you don't move."
Harry, Ron, Hermione, Fred and George set off for the entrance hall, Fred and George debating the ways in which Dumbledore might stop those who were under 17 entering the tournament.
"Who's this impartial judge who's going to decide who the champions are?" said Harry.
"Dunno," said Fred, "but it's them we'll have to fool.
I reckon a couple of drops of ageing potion might do it, George."
"Dumbledore knows you're not of age, though," said Ron.
"Yeah, but he's not the one who decides who the champion is he?" said Fred shrewdly.
"Sounds to me like once this judge knows who wants to enter, he'll choose the best from each school, and never mind how old they are.
Dumbledore's trying to stop us giving our names."
"People have died, though," said Hermione in a worried voice, as they walked through a door concealed behind a tapestry and started up another, narrower staircase.
"Yeah," said Fred airily, "but that was years ago, wasn't it? Anyway, where's the fun without a bit of risk?
Hey, Ron, what if we find out how to get round Dumbledore? Fancy entering?"
"What do you reckon?" Ron asked Harry. "Be cool to enter, wouldn't it? But I suppose they might want someone older. Don't know if we've learnt enough."
"I definitely haven't," came Neville's gloomy voice from behind Fred and George. "I expect my gran'd want me to try, though. She's always going on about how I should be upholding the family honour. I'll just have to..." "Oops!"
Neville's foot had sunk right through a step halfway up the staircase. There were many of these trick stairs at Hogwarts. It was second nature to most of the older students to jump this particular step, but Neville's memory was notoriously poor. Harry and Ron seized him under the armpits and pulled him out, while a suit of armour at the top of the stairs creaked and clanked, laughing wheezily.
"Shut it, you," said Ron, banging down its visor as they passed.
They made their way up to the entrance to Gryffindor Tower, which was concealed behind a large portrait of a fat lady in a pink silk dress.
"Password?" she said, as they approached.
"Balderdash," said George. "A prefect downstairs told me."
The portrait swung forwards to reveal a hole in the wall, through which they all climbed. A crackling fire was warming the circular common room, which was full of squashy armchairs and tables. Hermione cast the merrily dancing flames a dark look, and Harry distinctly heard her mutter, "Slave labour," before bidding them good night and disappearing through the doorway to the girls' dormitories. Harry, Ron and Neville climbed up the last spiral staircase until they reached their own dormitory, which was situated at the top of the tower. 5 four-poster beds with deep crimson hangings stood against the walls, each with its owner's trunk at the foot. Dean and Seamus were already getting into bed. Seamus had pinned his Ireland rosette to his headboard, and Dean had tacked up a poster of Victor Crumb over his bedside table. His old poster of West Ham football team was pinned right next to it.
"Mental," Ron sighed, shaking his head at the completely stationary soccer players.
Harry, Ron and Neville got into their pyjamas and into bed. Someone, a house elf, no doubt, had placed warming pans between the sheets. It was extremely comfortable, lying there in bed and listening to the storm raging outside.
"I might go in for it, you know," Ron said sleepily through the darkness. "If Fred and George find out how to... the tournament, you never know, do you?"
"Suppose not."
Harry rolled over in bed, a series of dazzling new pictures forming in his mind's eye. He had hoodwinked the impartial judge into believing he was 17. He had become Hogwarts champion. He was standing in the grounds, his arms raised in triumph in front of the whole school, all of whom were applauding and screaming. He had just won the Triwizard Tournament. Cho's face stood out particularly clearly in the blurred crowd, her face glowing with admiration. Harry grinned into his pillow, exceptionally glad that Ron couldn't see what he could.
Chapter 13. Mad-Eye Moody. The storm had blown itself out by the following morning, though the ceiling in the great hall was still gloomy. Heavy clouds of pewter grey swirled overhead as Harry, Ron and Hermione examined their new timetables at breakfast. A few seats along, Fred, George and Lee Jordan were discussing magical methods of ageing themselves and bluffing their way into the Triwizard Tournament.
"Today's not bad, outside all morning," said Ron, who was running his finger down the Monday column of his timetable. "Herbology with the Hufflepuffs and care of magical creatures. Damn it, we're still with the Slytherins."
"Double divination this afternoon," Harry groaned, looking down.
Divination was his least favourite subject, apart from potions. Professor Trelawney kept predicting Harry's death, which he found extremely annoying.
"You should have given it up like me, shouldn't you?"
said Hermione briskly, buttering herself some toast.
"Then you'd be doing something sensible, like arithmancy."
"You're eating again, I notice," said Ron, watching Hermione add liberal amounts of jam to her buttered toast.
"I've decided there are better ways of making a stand about elf rights," said Hermione haughtily.
"Yeah, and you were hungry," said Ron, grinning.
There was a sudden rustling noise above them, and 100 owls came soaring through the open windows, carrying the morning mail. Instinctively, Harry looked up, but there was no sign of white among the mass of brown and grey. The owls circled the tables, looking for the people to whom their letters and packages were addressed. A large tawny owl soared down to Neville Longbottom and deposited a parcel in his lap. Neville almost always forgot to pack something. On the other side of the hall, Draco Malfoy's eagle owl had landed on his shoulder, carrying what looked like his usual supply of sweets and cakes from home. Trying to ignore the sinking feeling of disappointment in his stomach, Harry returned to his porridge. Was it possible that something had happened to Hedwig, and that Sirius hadn't even got his letter? His preoccupation lasted all the way across the sodden vegetable path until they arrived in Greenhouse 3, but here he was distracted by Professor Sprout showing the class the ugliest plants Harry had ever seen. Indeed, they looked less like plants than thick black giant slugs protruding vertically out of the soil. Each was squirming slightly, and had a number of large, shiny swellings upon it, which appeared to be full of liquid.
"Bubo tubers," Professor Sprout told them briskly. "They need squeezing. You will collect the pus."
"The what?" said Seamus Finnegan, sounding revolted.
"Pus, Finnegan, pus," said Professor Sprout, "and it's extremely valuable, so don't waste it. You will collect the pus, I say, in these bottles. Wear your dragonhide gloves. It can do funny things to the skin when undiluted, bubotuber pus."
Squeezing the bubotubers was disgusting, but oddly satisfying. As each swelling was popped, a large amount of thick, yellowish-green liquid burst forth, which smelled strongly of petrol. They caught it in the bottles, as Professor Sprout had indicated, and by the end of the lesson had collected several pints.
"This'll keep Madam Pumphrey happy," said Professor Sprout, stoppering the last bottle with a cork. "An excellent remedy for the more stubborn forms of acne, bubotuber pus. Should stop students resorting to desperate measures to rid themselves of pimples."
"Like poor Eloise Midgin," said Hannah Abbott, a Hufflepuff, in a hushed voice. "She tried to curse hers off."
"Silly girl," said Professor Sprout, shaking her head. "But Madam Pumphrey fixed her nose back on in the end."
A booming bell echoed from the castle across the wet grounds, signalling the end of the lesson, and the class separated. The Hufflepuffs climbing the stone steps for Transfiguration, and the Gryffindors heading in the other direction, down the sloping lawn towards Hagrid's small wooden cabin, which stood on the edge of the Forbidden Forest. Hagrid was standing outside his hut, one hand on the collar of his enormous black boarhound, Fang. There were several open wooden crates on the ground at his feet, and Fang was whimpering and straining at his collar, apparently keen to investigate the contents more closely. As they drew nearer, an odd rattling noise reached their ears, punctuated by what sounded like minor explosions.
"Morning,"
Hagrid said, grinning at Harry, Ron and Hermione.
"Better wait for the Slytherins. They won't want to miss this. Blast-ended scroots."
"Come again?" said Ron. Hagrid pointed down into the crates.
"Eugh!"
squealed Lavender Brown, jumping backwards.
"Eugh!"
just about summed up the blast-ended scroots, in Harry's opinion. They looked like deformed, shell-less lobsters, horribly pale and slimy-looking, with legs sticking out in very odd places and no visible heads. There were about 100 of them in each crate, each about 6 inches long, crawling over each other, bumping blindly into the sides of the boxes. They were giving off a very powerful smell of rotting fish. Every now and then, sparks would fly out of the end of a scroot, and with a small fft, it would be propelled forwards several inches.
"Only just hatched," said Hagrid proudly, "so you'll be able to raise 'em yourselves. Thought we'd make a bit of a project of it."
"And why would we want to raise them?" said a cold voice. The Slytherins had arrived. The speaker was Draco Malfoy. Crabbe and Goyle were chuckling appreciatively at his words. Hagrid looked stumped at the question.
"I mean, what do they do?" asked Malfoy. "What is the point of them?"
Hagrid opened his mouth, apparently thinking hard. There was a few seconds' pause. Then he said roughly,
"That's next lesson, Malfoy. You're just feeding them today. Now you'll want to try them on a few different things. I've never had them before, not sure what they'll go for. I got ant eggs and frog livers and a bit of grass snake. Just try them out with a bit of each."
"First pus and now this," muttered Seamus. Nothing but deep affection for Hagrid could have made Harry, Ron and Hermione pick up squelchy handfuls of frog liver and lower them into the crates to tempt the blast-ended Scroots. Harry couldn't suppress the suspicion that the whole thing was entirely pointless, because the Scroots didn't seem to have mouths.
"Ouch!" yelled Dean Thomas after about 10 minutes. "It got me!"
Hagrid hurried over to him, looking anxious.
"Its end exploded," said Dean angrily, showing Hagrid a burn on his hand. "Ah, yeah, that can happen when they blast off," said Hagrid, nodding. "Eugh!" said Lavender Brown again. "Eugh, Hagrid! What's that pointy thing on it?" "Ah, some of them have got stings," said Hagrid enthusiastically.
Lavender quickly withdrew her hand from the box.
"I reckon they're the males. The females have got sort of sucker things on their bellies. I think they might be to suck blood."
"Well, I can certainly see why we're trying to keep them alive," said Malfoy sarcastically. "Who wouldn't want pets that can burn, sting and bite all at once?"
"Just because they're not very pretty, it doesn't mean they're not useful," Hermione snapped. "Dragon blood's amazingly magical, but you wouldn't want a dragon for a pet, would you?"
Harry and Ron grinned at Hagrid, who gave them a furtive smile from behind his bushy beard. Hagrid would have liked nothing better than a pet dragon, as Harry, Ron and Hermione knew only too well. He had owned one for a brief period during their first year, a vicious Norwegian ridgeback by the name of Norbert. Hagrid simply loved monstrous creatures. The more lethal, the better.
"Well, at least the Scroots are small," said Ron, as they made their way back up to the castle for lunch an hour later. "They are now," said Hermione in an exasperated voice. "But once Hagrid's found out what they eat, I expect they'll be 6 feet long."
"Well, that won't matter if they turn out to cure seasickness or something, will it?" said Ron, grinning slyly at her.
"You know perfectly well I only said that to shut Malfoy up," said Hermione. "As a matter of fact, I think he's right. The best thing to do would be to stamp on the lot of them before they start attacking us all."
They sat down at the Gryffindor table and helped themselves to lamb chops and potatoes. Hermione began to eat so fast that Harry and Ron stared at her.
"Is this the new stand on elf rights?" said Ron. "You're going to make yourself puke instead."
"No,"
said Hermione, with as much dignity as she could muster, with her mouth bulging with sprouts.
"I just want to get to the library."
"What?" said Ron in disbelief.
"Hermione, it's the first day back. We haven't even got homework yet."
Hermione shrugged and continued to shovel down her food as though she had not eaten for days. Then she leapt to her feet, said, "See you at dinner," and departed at high speed. When the bell rang to signal the start of afternoon lessons, Harry and Ron set off for North Tower, where, at the top of a tightly spiralling staircase, a silver stepladder led to a circular trapdoor in the ceiling and the room where Professor Trelawney lived. The familiar, sweet perfume emanating from the fire met their nostrils as they emerged at the top of the stepladder. As ever, the curtains were all closed. The circular room was bathed in a dim, reddish light cast by the many lamps, which were all draped with scarves and shawls. Harry and Ron walked through the mass of occupied chintz chairs and puffs that cluttered the room and sat down at the same small circular table.
"Good day,"
said the misty voice of Professor Trelawney right behind Harry, making him jump. a very thin woman with enormous glasses that made her eyes appear far too large for her face, Professor Trelawney was peering down at Harry with the tragic expression she always wore whenever she saw him. The usual large amount of beads, chains and bangles glittered upon her person in the firelight.
"You are preoccupied, my dear," she said mournfully to Harry. "My inner eye sees past your brave face to the troubled soul within, and I regret to say that your worries are not baseless. I see difficult times ahead for you. Alas, most difficult. I fear the thing you dread will indeed come to pass, and perhaps sooner than you think."
Her voice dropped almost to a whisper. Ron rolled his eyes at Harry, who looked stonily back. Professor Trelawney swept past them and seated herself in a large winged armchair before the fire, facing the class. Lavender Brown and Parvati Patil, who deeply admired Professor Trelawney, were sitting on puffs very close to her.
"My dears, it is time for us to consider the stars," she said. "The movements of the planets and the mysterious portents they reveal only to those who understand the steps of the celestial dance. Human destiny may be deciphered by the planetary rays which intermingle."
But Harry's thoughts had drifted. The perfumed fire always made him feel sleepy and dull-witted, and Professor Trelawney's rambling talks on fortune-telling never held him exactly spellbound, though he couldn't help thinking about what she had just said to him.
"I fear the thing you dread will indeed come to pass."
But Hermione was right, Harry thought irritably. Professor Trelawney really was an old fraud. He wasn't dreading anything at the moment at all. Well, unless you counted his fears that Sirius had been caught. But what did Professor Trelawney know? He had long since come to the conclusion that her brand of fortune-telling was really no more than lucky guesswork and a spooky manner. Except, of course, for that time at the end of last term, when she had made the prediction about Voldemort rising again. And Dumbledore himself had said that he thought that trance had been genuine when Harry had described it to him.
"Harry!" Ron muttered.
"What?" Harry looked around. The whole class was staring at him. He sat up straight. He had been almost dozing off, lost in the heat and his thoughts.
"I was saying, my dear, that you were clearly born under the baleful influence of Saturn," said Professor Trelawney, a faint note of resentment in her voice at the fact that he had obviously not been hanging on her words.
"Born under what, sorry?" said Harry.
"Saturn, dear, the planet Saturn," said Professor Trelawney, sounding definitely irritated that he wasn't riveted by this news. "I was saying that Saturn was surely in a position of power in the heavens at the moment of your birth. Your dark hair, your mean stature, tragic losses so young in life. I think I am right in saying, my dear, that you were born in midwinter."
"No," said Harry. "I was born in July." Ron hastily turned his laugh into a hacking cough. Half an hour later, each of them had been given a complicated circular chart and was attempting to fill in the position of the planets at their moment of birth. It was dull work, requiring much consultation of timetables and calculation of angles. "I've got two Neptunes here," said Harry, after a while, frowning down at his piece of parchment. "That can't be right, can it?"
"Ah," said Ron, imitating Professor Trelawney's mystical whisper. "When two Neptunes appear in the sky, it is a sure sign that a midget in glasses is being born, Harry."
Seamus and Dean, who were working nearby, sniggered loudly, though not loudly enough to mask the excited squeals from Lavender Brown.
"Oh, Professor, look! I think I've got an unexpected planet! Ooh, which one's that, Professor?"
"It is Uranus, my dear," said Professor Trelawney, peering down at the chart.
"Can I have a look at Uranus too, Lavender?" said Ron.
Most unfortunately, Professor Trelawney heard him, and it was this, perhaps, which made her give them so much homework at the end of the class.
"A detailed analysis of the way the planetary movements in the coming month will affect you, with reference to your personal chart," she snapped,
sounding much more like Professor McGonagall than her usual airy-fairy self.
"I want it ready to hand in next Monday, and no excuses."
"Miserable old bat," said Ron bitterly, as they joined the crowds descending the staircases back to the great hall and dinner. "That'll take all weekend, that will."
"Lots of homework," said Hermione brightly, catching up with them. "Professor Vector didn't give us any at all."
"Well, bully for Professor Vector," said Ron moodily. They reached the entrance hall, which was packed with people queuing for dinner. They had just joined the end of the line when a loud voice rang out behind them.
"Weasley! Hey, Weasley!"
Harry, Ron and Hermione turned. Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle were standing there, each looking thoroughly pleased about something.
"What?" said Ron shortly.
"Your dad's in the paper, Weasley," said Malfoy, brandishing a copy of the Daily Prophet and speaking very loudly so that everyone in the packed entrance hall could hear.
"Listen to this. Further mistakes at the Ministry of Magic. It seems as though the Ministry of Magic's troubles are not yet at an end," writes Rita Skeeter, special correspondent. "Recently under fire for its poor crowd control at the Quidditch World Cup, and still unable to account for the disappearance of one of its witches, the Ministry was plunged into fresh embarrassment yesterday by the antics of Arnold Weasley of the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts Office."
Malfoy looked up. "Imagine them not even getting his name right, Weasley. It's almost as though he's a complete non-entity, isn't it?" he crowed. Everyone in the entrance hall was listening now. Malfoy straightened the paper with a flourish and read on.
"Arnold Weasley, who was charged with possession of a flying car 2 years ago, was yesterday involved with a tussle with several Muggle lawkeepers, policemen, over a number of highly aggressive dustbins. Mr. Weasley appears to have rushed to the aid of Mad-Eye Moody, the aged ex-auror, who retired from the ministry when no longer able to tell the difference between a handshake and attempted murder. Unsurprisingly, Mr. Weasley found, upon arrival at Mr. Moody's heavily guarded house, that Mr. Moody had once again raised a false alarm. Mr. Weasley was forced to modify several memories before he could escape from the policeman, but refused to answer Daily Prophet questions about why he had involved the ministry in such an undignified and potentially embarrassing scene. And there's a picture, Weasley," said Malfoy, flipping the paper over and holding it up. "A picture of your parents outside their house, if you can call it a house. Your mother could do with losing a bit of weight, couldn't she?"
Ron was shaking with fury. Everyone was staring at him.
"Get stuffed, Malfoy," said Harry. "Come on, Ron."
"Oh, yeah, you were staying with them this summer, weren't you, Potter?" sneered Malfoy. "So tell me, is his mother really that porky, or is it just the picture?"
"You know your mother, Malfoy," said Harry. Both he and Hermione had grabbed the back of Ron's robes to stop him launching himself at Malfoy. "That expression she's got, like she's got dung under her nose. Has she always looked like that, or was it just because you were with her?"
Malfoy's pale face went slightly pink.
"Don't you dare insult my mother, Potter!" "Keep your fat mouth shut, then," said Harry, turning away. Bang!
Several people screamed. Harry felt something white-hot graze the side of his face. He plunged his hand into his robes for his wand, but before he'd even touched it, he heard a second loud bang and a roar which echoed through the entrance hall.
"Oh, no you don't, laddie!"
Harry spun around. Professor Moody was limping down the marble staircase.
His wand was out, and it was pointing right at a pure white ferret, which was shivering on the stone-flagged floor, exactly where Malfoy had been standing. There was a terrified silence in the entrance hall. Nobody but Moody was moving a muscle. Moody turned to look at Harry. At least, his normal eye was looking at Harry. The other one was pointing into the back of his head.
"Did he get you?"
Moody growled. His voice was low and gravelly. "No," said Harry. "Missed."
"Leave it!"
Moody shouted.
"Leave what?" Harry said, bewildered.
"Not you, him!"
Moody growled, jerking his thumb over his shoulder at Crabbe, who had just frozen, about to pick up the white ferret. It seemed that Moody's rolling eye was magical and could see out of the back of his head. Moody started to limp towards Crabbe, Goyle, and the ferret, which gave a terrified squeak and took off, streaking towards the dungeons.
"I don't think so!"
roared Moody, pointing his wand at the ferret again. It flew 10 feet into the air, fell with a smack to the floor, and then bounced upwards once more.
"I don't like people who attack when their opponents' backs turned," growled Moody, as the ferret bounced higher and higher, squealing in pain. "Stinking, cowardly, scummy thing to do."
The ferret flew through the air, its legs and tail flailing helplessly.
"Never do that again," said Moody, speaking each word as the ferret hit the stone floor and bounced upwards again.
"Professor Moody!" said a shocked voice.
Professor McGonagall was coming down the marble staircase with her arms full of books.
"Hello, Professor McGonagall," said Moody calmly, bouncing the ferret still higher.
What are you doing?"
said Professor McGonagall, her eyes following the bouncing ferret's progress through the air.
"Teaching,"
said Moody.
"Teach? Moody, is that a student?"
shrieked Professor McGonagall, the books spilling out of her arms.
"Yep,"
said Moody.
"No!"
cried Professor McGonagall, running down the stairs and pulling out her wand. A moment later, with a loud snapping noise, Draco Malfoy had reappeared, lying in a heap on the floor, with his sleek blonde hair all over his now brilliantly pink face. He got to his feet, wincing.
"Moody, we never use transfiguration as a punishment," said Professor McGonagall weakly. "Surely Professor Dumbledore told you that?"
"He might have mentioned it, yeah," said Moody, scratching his chin unconcernedly. "But I thought a good sharp shock."
"We give detentions, Moody, or speak to the offender's head of house."
"I'll do that then,"
said Moody, staring at Malfoy with great dislike. Malfoy, whose pale eyes were still watering with pain and humiliation, looked malevolently up at Moody and muttered something in which the words, "my father," were distinguishable.
"Oh, yeah,"
said Moody quietly, limping forward a few steps, the dull clunk of his wooden leg echoing around the hall.
"Well, I know your father of old, boy. You tell him Moody's keeping a close eye on his son. You tell him that from me. Now, your head of house'll be Snape, will it?"
"Yes," said Malfoy resentfully.
"Another old friend," growled Moody. "I've been looking forward to a chat with old Snape. Come on, you."
And he seized Malfoy's upper arm and marched him off towards the dungeons. Professor McGonagall stared anxiously after them for a few moments, then waved her wand at her fallen books, causing them to soar up into the air and back into her arms.
"Don't talk to me," Ron said quietly to Harry and Hermione, as they sat down at the Gryffindor table a few minutes later, surrounded by excited talk on all sides about what had just happened.
"Why not?"
said Hermione in surprise. "Because I want to fix that in my memory forever," said Ron, his eyes closed and an uplifted expression on his face. "Draco Malfoy, the amazing bouncing ferret."
Harry and Hermione both laughed, and Hermione began doling beef casserole onto each of their plates.
"He could have really hurt Malfoy, though," she said. "It was good, really, that Professor McGonagall stopped it."
"'Hermione!' said Ron furiously, his eyes snapping open again. "'You're ruining the best moment of my life!'
Hermione made an impatient noise and began to eat at top speed again.
"'Don't tell me you're going back to the library this evening,' said Harry, watching her.
"'Got to,' said Hermione thickly. "'Loads to do.'
"'But you told us, Professor Vector,
it's not schoolwork,' she said.
Within 5 minutes she had cleared her plate and departed. No sooner had she gone than her seat was taken by Fred Weasley.
"'Moody,' he said. "'How cool is he?'
"'Beyond cool,' said George, sitting down opposite Fred.
"'Super cool,' said the twins' best friend, Lee Jordan, sliding into the seat beside George.
"'We had him this afternoon,' he told Harry and Ron.
"'What was it like?' said Harry, eagerly.
Fred, George and Lee exchanged looks full of meaning.
"'Never had a lesson like it,' said Fred.
"'He knows, man,' said Lee.
"'Knows what?' said Ron, leaning forwards.
"'Knows what it's like to be out there doing it,' said George, impressively.
"'Doing what?' said Harry.
"'Fighting the dark arts,' said Fred.
"'He's seen it all,' said George.
"'Amazing,' said Lee. Ron dived into his bag for his timetable.
"'We haven't got him till Thursday,' he said, in a disappointed voice.